This is 94.7 WPVC Resistance Radio, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Welcome to Apropos of Something, airing every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence, coming to you from New York City. We talk to citizens who are most impacted by the latest scratch-your-head federal policies and bring you the most interesting guests we can find. We guarantee every show will be apropos of something. We are very grateful for the sponsorship of the Beckham team at Keller Williams Realty. Today, we are talking with Dr. Emily Blout, faculty fellow at the Internet Governance Lab and professorial lecturer at American University, and author of the upcoming book, Soft War, Media and Power in Modern Iran. And we are also honored to have Rahim Hamid here. He is an Ahwazi Arab, freelance journalist, and human rights activist. But first, Nancy, are you there? Oh, she's not there. We don't have Nancy, so I'm going to have to have her call back. Sorry about that, you guys. So I was on vacation last week, and I was going to talk all about my vacation with Nancy. And I went to Savannah, Charleston, Knoxville, had a lot of really good food to eat, and I was hoping to lift my head up from that and see that the world had changed. Hold on a moment. I'm going to... Emily, why don't you say hello to us?
Hello. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm great. I'm happy to be here and happy to be with you and talk with Nancy and you, Ellen.
Thank you.
I just want to introduce a little bit about myself and also encourage listeners to follow me on Twitter. I'm working up towards over 350 followers.
Wow. Nancy, yeah. Can you hear that? I don't hear an answer.
My Twitter is Emily Blout. It's at Emily Blout, and you can follow me there. You can also find me on LinkedIn. If you'd like to take a little look at my upcoming book, you can find it at softwarthebook.com. That's softwarthebook.com.
Thank you. Sorry for the technical difficulties. This is the first time that's happened.
Nancy,
you're there.
Yeah. Taking it personally.
Tell me what you've been doing this whole time while I've been sweating.
Oh, I've been imagining exactly this. The spinning of the plates that you are trying to accomplish.
Yes, please talk about how hard this is for me and make me feel better.
Emily, would you mind just circling around the parking lot a few times so we can discuss
the
burden that Emily...
No. I know. It's just a fault I have. I'm so glad you're there, Nancy.
Me too.
What is going on?
Me too. It's hanging by a thread. Anyway, it sounds like... Well, actually, Ellen, you tell me what.
Oh, really? You're going to make me now talk after that whole debacle?
No, yeah. Let's hear your quivering voice.
It's quivering. Well, I've already talked a little bit about. I had a great barbecue, great hush puppies, she crab soup.
Okay.
That's what I was going to talk about. The history in Charleston is amazing. There's some great stuff there, and they really are incorporating slavery into their tours now, which I was told that that they really weren't talking about that for a really long time.
Oh,
so it's a good thing. So what do you have? I could move on.
What has happened? I'm sorry.
I could move on, but you.
No, I have no comment on the state of our ability to talk about race today, let alone the Civil War. But I have to wonder now if the snafu in the start of this show means that Jared Kushner will take on the responsibility of handling our show as one of his many, many tasks, since apparently, you know, he gets to do everything now. So we may be on his radar.
Yeah.
This may be, he may be managing the show next week. It's one of his tasks.
I know. I mean, really. I was kind of out of the loop for a while, and when I came back, it was still as horrible as it was, and a couple other things happened. I don't know what happened with Bannon.
With what?
Bannon. Oh, you remember Bannon, Steve Bannon?
Oh, I just didn't hear the word.
Oh,
yes,
Bannon.
No, I'm sorry. Yeah,
for everyone, Nancy,
he got the office-based boot.
Nancy, I was just going
to
say.
I don't know if he got to collect his stapler. If he got to keep his stapler, but he's not in the NSA Uh-oh. Can you hear
whatever,
me?
Yeah, cool? I can hear you.
Oh, good. Cool. Okay. Anyway, so he's not on the advisory board. You know, he's still there, but he got, I don't, you know, you never know the correct word for all these things. I would say fired. Who knows? He just got, his chair is now missing from that table, let's just say.
Yeah. You know? But I thought it was a good thing, but who really knows? I wanted to mention an event going on today, if I may. There's a powwow today until 5 o'clock at UVA. It's hosted by the Native American Student Union. There'll be traditional dancing, drumming, and singing by the Turtle Clan and Zotai Singers. It's 1700 University Drive, and that's going to be across from Bodo's by Brooks Hall. They call it the Triangle of Grass, T-O-G. So that should be really cool. And we have an amazing show today.
I know, and apparently it's going to happen, which is a relief.
Thank goodness. I mean, Emily, maybe she'll be another co-host. She did such a great job. So, and that brings me to Emily. Dr. Emily Blout is here. She is a faculty fellow at the Internet Governance Lab and professorial lecturer at American University. She's the author of the forthcoming book, Soft War, Media, and Power in Modern Iran. Welcome, Dr. Blout.
Thank you.
Yes. Yeah. So what do you mean by soft war?
So soft war is a term that came into popularity within the Iranian media sphere in 2009, or right after the Iranian elections of 2009. But with a little bit more research, you would find this term being used more and more often starting in 2005. And it's basically some of us have hypothesized that it comes, or it's an iteration, a Persianization of Joseph Nye's idea of soft power. But the idea is generally that the West and the foreign entities are waging an assault against Iranian culture, and primarily through the media.
Mm-hmm. And what drew you to this topic?
Well, many things. Iran as a country has an in-depth history and a very diverse and rich culture. The language is absolutely beautiful. And so as a case study, Iran is a beautiful subject. Also, I was really interested in the use of media in the construction of power. And that's where my interest lies, and that's where my research is.
Mm-hmm. And that whole focus on the West, like this foreign conspiracy, how far back in Iran's history does that go?
Well, interestingly enough, I would posit that it goes back pretty far. One could trace it to the birth of the first mass communications, beginning with the German military in 1914. And even earlier, but it's essentially came to real presence in 1964 with a man named Ali Ahmed, and his notion of West toxification, which is the idea of cultural onslaught by the West. And this was at a time when the U.S. was heavily present in Iran, the British was heavily present in Iran, and Iran was being overwhelmed in a way by new cultural products and manufacturing and traditions and cultures.
Mm-hmm. Is everything state run now, or has it all, you know, is everything state run?
In terms of what?
In terms of the media and how people get their information, sorry.
Sure. So what is primarily a monopoly today, a state monopoly, right, is the television and radio sector. The newspapers are not the monopoly of the state. There are state-funded newspapers, but there's also newspapers that reflect political factions. And that's actually one of the ways, primary ways, that political factions express their ideas is through newspapers. So there's a diversity, comparative diversity of newspapers, but what's controlled by the state is the television and the radio sector.
Why do they leave the newspapers alone? How could they do that?
Well, that's a great question. And my theory is that newspapers, newspaper readership, subscriptions, and the audience in general is small. And actually, I would argue, falling. Whereas television and radio is really a mass communication. It's a medium in which the state can get its message out to a large population. And actually, as you will see, when we look at statistics and studies of Iran, we see that 99.5% of Iranian households has a television. So this is it's a great way to get your message out en masse.
Is the television, considering that number, is everything on the television for political purposes? Is there entertainment? You know, is it all just, you know, a message from the government in some form?
Well, I mean, again, I'm a scholar, so I would parse those words.
Sorry.
But in generally, as we understand, you know, education, entertainment, there's many different channels and purposes for each channel. In Iran, the major state networks, the major state channels, there's six of them. There's a youth channel. There's an entertainment channel. There's a film channel. So it's not just hard political news or religious programming, which there is a lot of, but there's also these different dedicated channels.
Right. But everything that winds up on the air is somehow sanctioned by the government? Is that fair to say?
I would say so. I mean, there has been points in which a message was not approved or it came out in a way in which the Nizam would have or the regime would not approve of. But in general, this is under the oversight of the supreme leader. So it is, in that sense, sanctioned by the government.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos of Something, which airs every Saturday from 10 to 11. We're speaking with Dr. Emily Blout. She's a faculty fellow and professorial lecturer at American University, expert on Iran and nationalism, the media, and power. Emily, question. So as a citizen, just living in the United States, how are you comparing it? What goes on in your mind with what's going on today in our government? And what do you see?
Every day I can't help make that comparison. Of course, you know, the experience of the Iranian people and the Iranian nation it cannot be understood or compared in terms of the pain and suffering that the people of Iran have gone through. But that tension and the concern and the rising authoritarianism in many ways that we see in the U.S. media by virtue of the U.S. system, which is very different than the Iranian system, there are parallels. And that raises, you know, serious concerns in my mind.
What are those parallels?
The parallels are the use of political spectacle, the use of these news events and flashy political devices to overt attention or to relay messages in which encourage the people not to push harder and question and come to informed conclusions, but rather to accept what is given to them. I think that trend in U.S. news consumption is similar to that is encouraged by the Iranian government over the years.
Is there anything looking back since because you're a historian. Looking back, was there anything in this culture or any others that you thought was a critical point where something could have changed in those countries and that we might learn from?
Well, actually, my research in the course of my research, I was really interested in. I have a master's in international security from the National Defense University here in the U.S., which is the premier military strategy college. And in that academic experience, I became really interested in the U.S. military's role in the creation and establishment of the Iranian communication sector, much of which has remained today. So in that sense, I think there was a key point in which the U.S. may have helped at least influence the tide of events. Again, that the U.S. is not the sole actor. It can't control history, but perhaps maybe something may have gone differently. And that was when a man named Habibullah Sabet introduced commercial television and that was in 1958. And the U.S. military, which was there at the time, was considering introducing its own television, U.S. Armed Forces Television. And it was at that critical point where the U.S. decided to launch its own state-operated foreign station that would directly compete with Sebit's station, that I think if something had changed, if the decisions had been thought through a little bit more, we might have helped encourage a more diverse, competitive sector within the Iranian ecosystem.
Wow. It's like a fantasy land. I can't even imagine that. That's such a good question, Ellen. I just can't imagine that there was a moment or two, not that there can't be in the future, but, you know, there was a point there. Has the West been the most, you know, egregious scapegoat? That's the only one I'm aware of, but is it all about hating the West over there?
I think there's equal enmity towards Israel. There's equal enmity towards the United Kingdom and even the Soviet Union or the Russians now. So, I mean, different nations have been the subject of Iranian regimes' ire in the past. But I think the great Satan, the U.S., has maintained that place in the, at least the modern narrative about the enemy of Iran.
And is it, I know you were saying that, well, I think that the newspapers are, you know, the outlet for dissent or opposing views. How able are people to express this, you know, outside? You know, how does that work? Can people resist?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the Iranian people are amazingly, first of all, just compared to in the region, and I guess I have my biases here, but the Iranian people are incredibly technologically savvy, educated, and there's a large youth population, you know, around 30s. There's a large population there, and they've grown up in an era where there is access to modern communications technologies, and any way that you can dissent or express yourself or live the life that you want to live, that avenue is going to be explored. I can't speak for every Iranian, but in most recent history, or just recently actually, we've seen Telegram, which is a encrypted service, come to prominence as a venue for political discussions among multiple parties, the members of the establishment per se, but also members outside of the establishment. We've seen Instagram become a really important cultural forum. And then, of course, we've seen marvelous film productions, most recently by Asghar Farhadi and The Salesman, which won the Academy Award for Best Foreign Language Film. So absolutely.
We're going to take a break now, and we'll come back with Dr. Emily Blout. She's an expert on Iran, the media, and nationalism after this message or two. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. You're listening to Apropos of Something with myself, Ellen Daniels, in the Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence in New York City. We're speaking with Dr. Emily Blout, author and faculty fellow, professorial lecturer at American University. And we're talking about Iran and the media and nationalism and power there.
And, you know, I know, Emily, you have definitely sort of touched on the idea that the technology is prevalent and being used by the government. But I was, so along those lines, I was wondering, one of the things you were writing about in your soft war story was the specific instance of the satellite dishes and how that became such a pivotal moment for how the government started to co-opt even more of the airwaves. So I was just wondering if you could share that story of the satellite dish.
Sure. So satellite dishes were introduced they became a popular medium for receiving satellite television in the 1990s, in the early 1990s. And about 1993, there was a flood of cheap satellite dishes flooding the Iranian marketplace. And this was not just in Tehran, but also in all of the major urban centers all over Iran. And by the way, I'd also want to just mention that when I'm talking about Iran, I use the word nation, but I should have used the word really country, and also just emphasize how diverse this country actually is in terms of its ethnic populations, its religious populations, its cultures, and its subcultures. For instance, there's Arabs, there's Turks, there's Baluches, there's Kurds, and there's a variety of languages also. And there's Baha'is in addition to Shi'i and in addition to Sunni Muslims. And there also is a formidable Jewish population, which is also an interesting area for U.S. scholars to look at and has not been researched as much as it should be. So again, I just want to preface that. But going back to the satellite story and the encounter, I think this really highlights the way that the Iranian government chose to deal with the onslaught of this new communications technology and the challenge that it posed to its monopoly on television is informative, and it gives us clues and to how the government would then deal with the rise of the internet. So it was in 1994. There was a major debate within the Majlis. I won't burden you with that, but the complexity is there when you delve into it. It really reflects, again, myriad of different opinions about how best to deal with this transformative technology, and which, you know, DBS or direct broadcasting satellite or satellite television was at that point. And it foreshadows how the government would then deal with the internet, which is not to cut it off, but to try to prohibit it and try to co-opt it and try to, at the same time, maintain a facade of plurality, of diversity in the media space for foreign and internal consumption.
And the, for instance, like the outcome of the 2009 election, the contested outcome of it, how did the media, the government, use that to their benefit?
Sure. Well, I interestingly enough, and I love that question because, interestingly enough, you can see a government that was prepared for this in many ways. The internet policies and policy landscape that was in place in 2009 in the contested elections over the re-election of Ahmadinejad was, it was there and it was created in 2003. So it was, you know, in essence there. The regime then built upon that later in the aftermath of these protests to create a pretty advanced infrastructure, a policy infrastructure and rhetoric in terms of internet and the way that the country is going to deal with the internet. They introduced this idea of a national internet, which we usually just call Shoma, and that's actually in its second phase. And the national internet is going to be a really interesting project because it's moving forward at a considerable pace now, but also the role that it plays later in the elections in May, perhaps not, but in future elections, it'll be interesting. One thing I would just note is that Iran, unlike other regimes such as Syria and Iraq, in Egypt, chose not to shut off its internet when there was these mass protests. You see this happening in the Arab protests later in 2010. The Iranians chose not to shut off internet access altogether. Instead, they reduced speeds. They created other loopholes to maintain this illusion of access.
And given that, you know, the current regime makes obedience a mandate, how difficult in your mind is it to condition at this point public opinion?
Well, I think that's the eternal struggle, right? Television and broadcasting and the internet and these other mediums for communication are just one component of a larger strategy, or at least a larger program to ensure the dominance of this regime's ideology. So it's mostly political, it's religious, but it's part of a larger strategy.
And like you were, which I totally agree, like you were saying, there are, to Ellen's question, there are some more than a few parallels between us right now in terms of the government wanting to control information. So with such a nationalistic position like that, and how can they become a global leader when they're similar to us right now, when they're so interested in looking and keeping their themselves looking inward?
Well, that's a really good question, and I think it's also important to realize that there's so many different factions within the Iranian establishment, the ruling establishment, and Rouhani, the president now, and Zarif, the foreign minister. There's many different voices who don't think that monopoly or closing off the Iranian hyper media space to the rest of the world is a good thing, and is really advocating opening up to the world. So it's a tricky balance, and that tension is what makes Iran so dynamic, and makes it still have that potential to become a major world power.
And I know from speaking with you that you have been trying to get over there to do a lot of that research that you are doing. But I was wondering if you could share just the struggle you had trying to get over there.
Yes, I think we talked about this briefly, but I have tried to get to Iran in some form or fashion, back door, front door, 12 times now and counting. I have been routinely rejected to the point where a day before I found out I can't go. I've had friends and colleagues accepted, and I have not been able to go. And I think this is because of my position generally on advocating diplomacy with Iran, and as just the most rational thing to do as a U.S., as the lead power in the world, and how important it is to really engage with both our enemies and our friends. I think that's one position that probably raised the red flag to members of the regime. And I think the other thing is probably my interest as an academic. Academics are very threatening to some members of the regime, so that might have put me on the no-fly list, as you could say.
But you have colleagues who are also, academics as well, and they're okay to go?
I do, but then I also have colleagues who are imprisoned right now. So it's very dangerous to go, especially if you're an Iranian American, because unlike an American just like me who doesn't have that other passport, the dual nationality, Iranian Americans are considered, when they're in Iran, they're on sovereign territory, and therefore the U.S. really can't do anything to intervene. And unfortunately, we don't have diplomatic relations, so we have no official gateway to intervene.
So your colleagues are Americans and they're in prison there?
Iranian Americans, right.
Wow. Can you just say that again about the status of a visiting Iranian American I know that's way too wordy, but what happens to, how safe are they when they travel?
Well, they're not safe at all. I mean, so they're under serious scrutiny. I mean, the famous case was Hala Esfandiari, who I knew personally, a major human rights advocate, but also a scholar at the Wilson Center. She goes there to see her dying mother, out of need, not for an academic venture, not to do research, not to write about it, just to go see her mother. And she, the 70-plus-year-old woman, is put into to solitary confinement and just abused mentally and interrogated about her work in the U.S. So it's a really tricky thing, and the regime has been very, very harsh and horrible to many, many persons, as we will see when we talk to Rahim
later. And that's a good lead-in. We are going to be speaking to Rahim Hamid. He is a Hawazi Arab, and he'll be talking about his people there, the Hawazis. And I wanted to thank you, Emily, for doing such a great job explaining this to us and co-hosting at the beginning.
Yeah, thank you, Ellen. Yeah, exactly.
So thank you, Dr. Emily Blout. Her upcoming book is Soft War, Media and Power in Modern Iran. Thank you.
Thanks.
So before we talk to Rahim, just as if we have to really do the day's disaster.
And I'll beat this horse one more time. And it wasn't the start of the show. That was not it. I have a different one.
Okay, what is that?
Okay, so my day's disaster is the head of the EPA, Mr. Scott Pruitt, while we were away, decided that he knows better than science and his own staff, and he gave the green light to allow the use of a pesticide that has been known to damage kids' brains, and meaning lowering their IQ and possibly autism. It was on track to be stopped, but he decided that, you know, damn the health risks. We're returning, you know, this is back on, and, of course, that will make the people at Dow very happy.
Hmm. Well, this is going to...
what do you got?
This will pale in comparison. That's horrible. But it is probably from the week before because I was away, but the repealing of the internet privacy rules, which weren't even in effect yet. Privacy rules were to go into effect in December, but Trump has repealed those. So companies like Comcast, Verizon can sell your web browsing history. But one bright point about that is I hope that Cards Against Humanity game creator does come through with his threat to buy the browser history of every congressman and congressional aide and publish it. I hope that happens.
That's such a good one, Ellen.
Yeah.
I know. It's just, I mean, they cannot stop themselves from breaking things that, you know, that don't need to be. And
right.
Yeah, I love that, what you said about, you know, let it backfire on the ones who perpetrated it. That'd be great.
So, with no further ado, I would love to introduce our second guest, Rahim Hamid. He is an Ahwazi Arab, a freelance journalist, and human rights activist. Welcome, Rahim.
Hi. Thank you for having me today. I just want to thank you for giving me this opportunity, and thank you for your noble humanitarian support for the voices of people in the Middle East, including Ahwazi Arab people who are under Iranian occupation and oppression for almost a century.
Thank you. Thank you for thanking us. We thank you.
You're welcome.
So Ahwaz, or sometimes known, I think, as Ahwaz, is a region in the south and southwest of Iran with 8 to 10 million people. Can you give us some background on the Ahwazi people?
Yeah, absolutely. Ahwaz region is historically called Arabistan, meaning lands of Arab, and was independent of Iran and was annexed and occupied by the Shah of Iran, Reza Pahlavi, during 1925, whose forces invaded Ahwaz in 1925, and after overthrowing and murdering the last Arab ruler of Arabistan, or Ahwaz, they initiated the program of Persianization by enforcing Persian or Farsi as the official language and banning the teaching of Arabic in the school in the region. And then they renamed the region from its historic name to Khuzestan to further alienate it from its Arab identity.
Wow, and they've done quite a few things. I read about, if you don't mind, I mean, there were so many crazy things.
Yeah,
Ahwazis can't cook their own kind of cultural meals. They can't name their children Arabic names. I mean, the list goes on. They force males to marry Persian women.
Yeah, there are many things, and if you give me a chance,
yes, I will
talk about everything possible. The full diminution and manifestation of poverty, for example, can be understood as it relates to Ahwazi people and their homeland. Despite the bounteous natural wealth and mineral wealth in Ahwaz region, with over 90% of oil and gas wealth claimed by Iran located in the region, crushing medieval poverty is rampant among Ahwazi Arab people. Ahwazi are victim of institutionalized widespread destitution and deprivation, such as, for example, lack of equal employment opportunity, decent education, health care, housing, even clean drinking water, as well as the denial of access to social, political, and economic rights. And this scourge of poverty is rampant in Ahwazi area, alike malignant fatal disease hits and shatters and displaces Ahwazi people. This leading cause actually behind the spreading poverty in Ahwaz can in part be attributed to the unequal employment opportunity and also because of the Iranian regime discriminatory policy directed against Ahwazi who continue to demand their basic right, but they were faced with brutal oppression.
And you were saying it's because of the very, you know, rich country that it is with oil and gas.
Yes.
Okay.
You know, Iranian regime view Ahwazi Arab people as a threat to their national security because this region is wealth with oil and gas, and without Ahwaz, the Iran cannot survive.
Right.
Okay.
I am going to ask you a really simple question, which maybe even anyway, but if you can answer this question, why do you think there is anti-Arab racism? Where does it come from? Obviously, it's very useful. I get that. But where does it come from?
The systematic discrimination policy that is inflicted against Ahwazi people originated from the Persian state race's ideology of building a homogeneous nation to establish an absolute monoethnic country. They call it Persian Empire. And also what actually motivates racism among Persian against Arab in general and Ahwazi Arab in particular, along with Kurds, Turks, Baluch, is the racial belief instilled in the Persian mind that they come from a special superior Aryan race, while the rest of other ethnic groups have some inferior racial traits that result in that group being detestable.
Mm, okay. We're going to come back because we have a lot to talk about with Rahim Hamid. He is an Ahwazi Arab, freelance journalist, and human rights activist, and we're very honored to have him here. And we'll come back after this break. We are back on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville and Resistance Radio. We are speaking with Rahim Hamid, Ahwazi Arab, freelance journalist, human rights activist.
And Rahim, I know that you certainly had revealed a significant amount of detail before the commercial break, but I just want to make sure that you, I didn't want to ask you something else if you weren't done. Okay, go ahead, please.
The thing that I want to mention that Ahwazi people during all these years have experienced nothing but oppression, systematic crackdown on their language, their culture, their and imprisonment, and they face imprisonment and execution on daily basis, as well as the neglect and devastation to their environment since this region was occupied by Iran in 1925, and the situation has become much worse since the Mullah regime seized control in 1979, and this since the emergence of the Islamic Republic regime. All the people actually living in Iran, not only Ahwazi Arab people, have been forced to endure harsh economic condition, multifaceted repression, terrible injustice, and even the deprivation of the most basic necessities as that are most dear to life.
So it's as horrible as it has been. It sounds like it is. It is more so. It has gotten even worse. Is that? Did I hear that correctly?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
For the ethnic minorities, the Iranian regime, by its Persianization policy, spared no effort to destroy the foundation of Ahwazi existence, their shared language, culture, and history. And but they try to, they are very keen in promoting and teaching the Persian language internally and even overseas, but they neglecting that comes at the expense of four languages of minorities population there, the Arab language of the Ahwazis, the Turkish language of the Turk, as well as the language of the Kurdish and Baluchi people. All this group are forbidden from being taught in their native language, although the Iranian current constitution under Article 19 stipulates that all ethnic groups have right to in education in their mother language, but it has never been instituted into practice despite passing into law about, I think, 30 years ago.
Wow.
Right. That's why the Constitution's great once we, you know, adhere to it, but it doesn't mean a lot in some places, and it might not mean a lot here. I hope that's not true. Just a little bit of your personal story. You were imprisoned. I mean, just tell us a little so we can, you know, hear from you.
I entered university in 2005, and at that time, the Ahwazi Arab popular uprising broke out into the face of the Iranian regime oppression. And the Iranian regime, in order to intimidate and spread terror among the protesters, they began to arrest people randomly and systematically executing many of the prominent key activists in the region. And I was one of those people who was arrested at university just because of my cultural and civil activism in for that was aimed at promoting the Arab culture and identity that was oppressed by Iran among the students. But I was arrested by the intelligence agent, and I took to unknown location. I was subjected to harsh tortures and unbearable psychological pressure, and I was in the detention about 15 days, and even I cannot find words to describe what's happened for me. But after that, they transferred me to the prison called Sepidar, and there I started to develop internal bleeding because of the excessive torture that by punching, kicking in my stomach, I started to have many health issues, and my family managed to bail me out. And after I got from the prison out, I was admitted to the hospital, and doctor diagnosed that I have rupture in multiple areas in my intestine, and the doctor had to extract my gallbladder, my pancreas, small part of my intestine, and colon as well. And it means that I maimed forever. And since that time up to now, I'm struggling with many health issues, and I don't know how can I express those month that I was in a prison, but it is a real nightmare that I see it like a movie in front of my eyes every day. I cannot forget about such a barbarian torture that I have been inflicted while I was in prison, but I was one of those victims. There are many victims in the Ahwazi prison that nobody knows about them, and the world just I have no words.
The forgotten people, I think, was one of the titles. One of the titles of your articles, "The Forgotten People." It's horrific. And
I remember when I resisted or cursed them, they intensified the torture by punching and kicking me. And sometimes they bring recorder for me, and I was hearing screaming ladies. The agent were telling me, "This is your sister. We are giving her sexual pressure as she is bitch like you, Ahwazi Arab moron." This is a big wound that I never forget about it.
Mm-hmm. And that's, I'm sure that motivated you, obviously, to become a journalist. How did you get out of that country? And then we could talk a little bit about your journalism.
Well, despite my severe health problem, I resumed my activity simply because I couldn't close my eyes and my mind to the oppression that the Iranian regime posing on my Ahwazi people. Honestly, I came out of the country because I have a message. I wanted to spread it in the world. I want to raise awareness about the plight of my people. my oppressed people who do not have voice in the international community, even in the media. And the media blackout is one of the biggest barrier in front of us to get our message out. So by writing articles in English, reports, interviews, and knocking every door that is possible for me, are trying to just raise awareness on this cause. It is a fair cause and need to be heard, and people in the world need to stand in the solidarity with these oppressed people.
You know, I was wondering, I know that you are obviously here, but before you got here, you were writing about this in Iran. So were you in constant fear that you would, despite your health issues that they let you out for, were you in fear they'd imprison you again?
Yeah, when I was there, I was attending civil and cultural seminars and something like that. I wasn't writing article because, you know, it's impossible to write article and to be a journalist in Iran. How is it possible? You know, it's a miracle to survive if you do this in Iran. But I was spreading the message among the young generation that we should stand strong in the face of the Iranian oppression, not to give up, and we have to preserve our cultures, we have to preserve our language, despite the ongoing Persianizations policy that try to eradicate the region from its Arab identity. So I was doing like this by gathering people and talking about this sometimes secretly in our home or other places. But I wasn't writing article. But I was in touch with Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, and I was sending them compelling evidences of the appalling human rights violation that are taking place on Ahwaz. Like, for example, the Iranian regime arrested my teacher and executed two of them, Hashim Shabani and Hadi Rashidi, just because Hashim Shabani was a poet, and they accused him that he's waging war against God. And the God, when they mean by the God, they mean the supreme leader, Ali Khamenei. Isir. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Right. I know that those leaders, once they're so-called elected, then they get the title of spiritual leader or something like that.
I just want to talk briefly about Ahwazi political prisoner, that they lack access to fair trials to defend themselves. And the court of the Iran regime called Revolutionary Court that are considered among Ahwazi and other ethnic groups and even Persian themselves as one-sided and biased. In this court, Ahwazi prisoner must be silent and only allowed to hear the list of unfounded allegations before the judge. And the other thing is forced confession under torture has been one of the most constant characteristics of the Iranian regime, particularly against human rights activists. And this is designed to force Ahwazi political prisoner to confess to committing serious crimes or to implicate others. And despite Ahwazi Arab prisoner retracting their confessions during the trial, the Iranian court accept this confession as evidence of guilt and sentence the detainees to long periods of imprisonment or probably execution that they did.
Is it fair to say the government sort of has a ranking system of their cruel injustice that is, you know, it can go from worse to even worse as far as the rights?
If you mean human rights violation, I can tell you that the appalling human rights situation in Iran hasn't improved since Hassan Rouhani became a president of the Islamic Republic of Iran in 2013. He was described in some circle in the West as a moderate and reformer. Since taking the office, more than 4,000 people have been executed under Rouhani watch. And this is the biggest scale of execution in the past 25 years. And add to this is the black pages of the regime history of human rights violation since the Iranian Revolution in 1979.
Is anything being done by any government, and what can people do?
The things that is really heartbreaking is the international community ignore the human rights that are committed against people in Iran, and under the pretext of the nuclear program, which completely failed to take into account the interests of the oppressed people of the country. We firmly reject the random execution of a Ahwazi citizen, but we do not have any chance to speak and raise awareness of the crime of the Iranian regime does, and we demand the international community to take notice, because this can be understood by the oppressed people that this rapprochement of the West with the Iranian regime can be a green light to the regime to kill more Ahwazi people and other member of ethnic groups.
Mm-hmm. Do you have, I think on our website, WPVC website, which actually is, WPVC94.7.org, we will list your website, and you can also Google your name.
I think it's good that those people who are interested and curious about the Ahwazi people suffering, they can visit ahwazmonitor.info. It's a website, is a great website, and it's publishing articles, report, just in English, and so people can get a good idea of what's going on in the region and even in the Iran.
Okay, yeah. And also, I think I might have misspoke. It's 947wpvc.org. I will have information there. I'll have that website there as well. So thank you so much.
You're welcome, Rahim. I'm really happy and excited to talk about
I'm glad you got to tell some of your story. It was great to meet you, Rahim.
Yes, and you know, we will have you back. We can have you both back because there's always so much more to hear about. So thank you, Dr. Emily Blout. She is a faculty fellow and lecturer at American University. And her book is coming out, Soft War, Media and Power in Modern Iran. And, of course, Rahim Hamid, we were just speaking with. He is a Ahwazi Arab, freelance journalist, and human rights activist. He writes constantly, I believe, and you can find him, as I said, on our website. So thank you both so, so much for being here.
Yeah, indeed.
Hey, Nancy.
This might be just an ideal time to have a palate cleanser from that interview, and I have one, and it is Ellen. I hope it's okay that I say this, but we do have a Twitter account, and they're silent.
Go on.
Do you mind that I'm saying
this? Bated breath. No, we only have like a minute, so go for it.
Okay, it is AOS Radio, and I say that perhaps prematurely, because it is, you know, I would love to hear how our listeners don't think about world events constantly, which is a problem for me. And if anyone wants to let us know how they solve that, that would be great. Also, of course, comments, the obvious. I know everyone knows how to use Twitter. You know, use it for what it's also for, but I'd love to put in that P.S. about how do you escape. Okay, what do you got?
That's great. Well, it's Passover. I will be celebrating a little bit of Passover starting Monday, talking about freedom. And it's a great holiday to just interpret, I think, the meaning of that holiday in ways that are current. So the themes are oppression and freedom and all kinds of things like that. So I like doing that. And I wanted to mention that next week we have a guest scheduled named Garnett Cadogan. He is a really interesting person. He walks everywhere. He's a writer. He's an editor. He has a forthcoming book on walking, on the dangers of walking while black. He's written about his experience in New Orleans, New York, Charlottesville, and how that differed from walking in Kingston, Jamaica. He is fascinating. So I'm really excited he's making some time for us. And remember, no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. Our theme music is by Springtide, and we'll talk to you later, Nance.
That sounds good. We will, Alice. We will do that next week, for
all
sure.
All right, great.
Okay. All right, bye.